things are not looking good for South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol.
As of early Thursday morning in Seoul, opposition lawmakers have filed a motion to impeach the president, and reports are coming out that it could go to a vote as early as Friday.
A controversial presidential pardon in the U.S.
He said he wrestled with this, and because he believes in the justice system, but he also believes that the war politics infected the process and led to a miscarriage of justice.
And Namibia elects its first woman president.
Her being the first lady, she needs to make a mark in history as well, being one of the best female ladies.
Today is Thursday, December 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. We begin in Seoul, where on Wednesday, South Korean opposition lawmakers submitted a motion to impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol. This just hours after the president briefly imposed martial law in a move that surprised the nation and many world leaders. VOA correspondent William Gallo is in Seoul and gets us up to speed.
Night has fallen here in Seoul, South Korea, about 24 hours after South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law in a very unexpected move that plunged this country into a period of political uncertainty. We've seen several developments throughout the day, the most important of which is the South Korean opposition has begun impeachment proceedings against Yoon. It's unclear if they will have enough support in the National Assembly to get a two-thirds majority to impeach Yoon. They'd need to pry 9 members away from South Korea's ruling Conservative People Power Party in order for that impeachment motion to pass. If that is able to happen, the impeachment would then go to the Constitutional Court, which would have to confirm the impeachment. That process would take many weeks. It's unclear exactly where it will lead, but for now, it seems that South Koreans are taking to the streets. We've seen protests throughout the day, mostly small. Those protests are expected to pick up in the nighttime, also on the weekends, as members of the opposition continue to try to put pressure on South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol to resign. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
President Yoon's move to declare martial law to end a political impasse will likely lead to his removal from office, and it might even cause his conservative party to lose power, which would change the dynamic in the region. For more context, I'm joined by Emma Whitmire. She's a senior program officer at the Asia Society Policy Institute.
Why the president felt this was the only option to draw attention and solve some of the challenges being faced in the National Assembly is really beyond me and is very troubling. I don't think anyone could have predicted that this was going to take place, and even members closest to him didn't see this coming.
So President Yoon declared martial law, then faced tremendous pressure, pulled that back, and now it looks like he's going to be impeached. What are you seeing from the news, from maybe contacts you've got? What do you think will happen?
Yeah, so we know on Wednesday morning, 190 of the 300 members of the National Assembly that were present all voted to lift the order, and this included members of the president's party. As of early Thursday morning in Seoul, opposition lawmakers have filed a motion to impeach the president, and reports are coming out that it could go to a vote as early as Friday. If it were to pass, it would require two-thirds of the National Assembly to vote in favor, which is 200 of 300 members.
Is that likely?
Well, at this time, there are about 108 members of his party in the National Assembly. And if 190 voted to lift the order, it does look very optimistic that they'll pass this.
And who would become president then?
So it's my understanding that the Prime Minister Han Duck-soo would then step in and take place as the president until elections would occur in the next 60 days.
South Korea has been for a long time one of the U.S.'s strongest allies in the region. This is happening at a time, of course, of presidential transition here in the U.S., but also at a time when China is exerting more and more force, more and more power in the Pacific. How damaging? How unsettling are the actions in South Korea to the Pacific region, to the Korean-American relationship? What's the big picture?
So to give a little context, in the last presidential election in South Korea, it was super close between President Yoon and the Democratic Party candidate Lee Jae-myung. President Yoon came out ahead with roughly less than a percentage point. And while it's hard to say with certainty which party or person could be in charge next, the last election signals that there's a large portion of the population that wants to see the Liberal Democratic Party take office. If they were to win, then we could expect to see a shift in South Korea's foreign policy. The two sides have really differing perspectives on what engagement with other regional actors looks like. Historically, the Democratic Party has been rather open to engaging with North Korea. As we saw under the previous president, Moon Jae-in, and has been less interested in engagement with countries like Japan and the United States. So while there are differing views from either side of the aisle, bipartisan agreement is that the martial law declaration is not the best path forward for South Korea.
What do you think people in Beijing and Tokyo and other regional capitals are saying about this? Are they quietly laughing or are they nervous too?
I don't think they're laughing, but I think they're watching closely to see what's going to happen in the coming days and weeks in South Korea if the president is impeached and who could take the role next and what that means for South Korea's future.
South Korea is a relatively young democracy, about 40 years old or so, maybe a little more. What does this whole episode say about the country's democratic institutions, about its ability to weather this kind of storm and go forward?
Yeah, so South Korea is a democratic country, and this is one of its many strengths. With the overturn of Yoon's martial law order, it really shows the resilience of South Korea's democratic process, especially that the National Assembly was able to quickly come together just hours after the declaration and was able to vote and lift the order. While the situation is still ongoing and the hope is that it remains peaceful, it's really important that the voices of the people are heard, and South Korea has shown that it's listening.
Emma Whitmire is with the Asia Society Policy Institute. We reached her in New York. Ms. Whitmire, thanks very much for being with us on what is no doubt a very busy afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Ukrainian politicians were in Washington and in Europe on Wednesday, trying to secure support as Donald Trump is preparing to return to office. Anna Chernikova has more from Kyiv.
Andriy Sybiha, the Ukrainian Minister of Foreign Affairs, is in Brussels to meet with his NATO counterparts to discuss security guarantees for Ukraine. Sybiha recalled the signing of the Budapest Memorandum 30 years ago, under which Ukraine agreed to give up its nuclear weapons in exchange for security assurances. He said that Ukraine had learned a bitter lesson from the Budapest Memorandum, and such mistakes should not be repeated. He said that this is a good reminder that no decisions on long-term security solutions at the expense of Ukrainian security are acceptable. Sybiha noted that Russia's goals have not changed. Russia seeks Ukraine's surrender and the dismantling of Ukrainian statehood. He said Ukraine, together with its allies, must do everything to force Russia to adjust comprehensive, sustainable peace. He noted that Ukraine is discussing with its allies the concept of peace through force, including the supply of more air defense systems to protect nuclear energy-related facilities. Sybiha also confirmed the trip of Andriy Yermak, the head of the Office of the President of Ukraine, to Washington. He said that Andriy Yermak is in the United States to establish relationships with representatives of the incoming Trump administration. Reportedly, Yermak is expected to meet with Trump's nominee for special envoy on Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, to discuss, among other things, Trump's future policy and continuation of U.S. support. Experts in Ukraine say this visit could also be a part of negotiations for a potential peace negotiation between Ukraine and Russia that President Trump is hoping to implement. The meeting in Washington has some in Kyiv nervous, When Kellogg was previously National Security Advisor to then-Vice President Mike Pence, his plan for ending the war involved freezing the battle lines at their prevailing locations and forcing both Kyiv and Moscow to the negotiating table, something Kyiv had previously rejected. Meanwhile, Ukrainian military authorities confirmed additional fortification lines are being built in Zaporizhia to ensure the city can repel a new wave of Russian ground attacks, which is expected soon, according to recent intelligence data. More air attacks are also reported in Russia. In the early hours of Wednesday, explosions were confirmed near the Dyagilev Air Base in Ryazan by local authorities. Russian officials say the air base was attacked by Ukrainian drones. No information on casualties or damage was provided. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
Brian Thompson, the CEO of United Healthcare, was shot to death early Wednesday in New York in what police are calling a brazen targeted attack. Though officials said the attack appeared to be planned, they did not yet have a motive for the shooting. United Healthcare is among the largest for-profit health insurance companies in the United States.
U.S. President Joe Biden got a firsthand look Wednesday at a U.S.-financed rail project that weaves together his personal love of railroads with his desire to leave a legacy in Africa that will outlive his administration. The Lobito Corridor is a 1,300-kilometer rail line stretching from copper-rich Zambia to the port of Lobito in Angola. The railway is meant to form a strategic economic corridor under the Biden administration's Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment. It's an initiative meant to counter China's well-established sprawling Belt and Road Initiative.
British authorities say they have dismantled two massive money laundering operations linked to Russia that were used by oligarchs, organized crime groups, cybercriminals, and drug dealers. The international sting operation seized about $25.4 million in cash and cryptocurrency and arrested 84 suspects. The money laundering networks allowed criminals and wealthy Russians to convert cash to cryptocurrency and vice versa. They also helped them hide the illegal source of their funds or evade sanctions that were imposed after Russia invaded Ukraine. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Presidential pardons, especially at the end of a president's term, are often controversial. And so it is with Joe Biden, who pardoned his son, Hunter Biden, earlier this week, ending a political saga that has divided U.S. lawmakers for years. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
Each of us is equal before the law.
With just weeks left in his administration, President Joe Biden granted a pardon to his son, Hunter. The White House on Monday defended the decision to clear the younger Biden of felony gun and tax fraud convictions. Karine Jean-Pierre is the White House press secretary.
He said he wrestled with this. And because he believes in the justice system, but he also believes that the war politics infected the process and led to a miscarriage of justice.
Earlier this year, Biden pledged not to issue a pardon, saying that no one in the United States was above the law.
I said I abide by the jury decision, and I will do that, and I will not pardon him.
The top Senate Democrat Tuesday refused to answer multiple questions about the pardon. Chuck Schumer is the Senate Majority Leader.
I got nothing for you on that.
House Republicans investigated Hunter Biden's overseas dealings, arguing Joe Biden should be impeached for benefiting from them, though no persuasive evidence of that was ever provided. Hunter Biden's attorney Mark Garagos says the pardon was necessary.
I don't know how anybody would, with a straight face, would argue that it wasn't a politically inspired prosecution.
Biden is not the first U.S. president to pardon a relative, but one legal analyst said the move is troubling. Claire Finkelstein is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
It is quite regrettable that he couldn't set the example of letting justice take its course, and that he had, that he felt he had to take this highly politicized step with pardons, because it does send us down a chute, or at least reinforce a path with regard to using the pardon power in this way.
During his first term, Trump granted executive clemency to 237 individuals, a significant number of whom were convicted of fraud or public corruption. Many of them bypassed the traditional process of applying for a pardon.
Let's not forget that Donald Trump has said in the past that he had the right to self-pardon, which is the ultimate in politicized pardons.
Trump has also pledged to pardon those convicted of attacking the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, in an attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
And speaking of presidential politics, we turn our attention now to southwestern Africa, where Namibia has just elected Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah as its first woman president.
She has a point to prove, I think. Because her being the first lady, she needs to make a mark in history as well. Being the, one of the best female ladies. And also Namibia needs to improve. And I believe she is for the people.
That's Tuafani Hadibo, a supporter of the new president. Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah of the ruling SWAPO party is currently serving as vice president, and her victory will extend SWAPO's 34 years in power since it led Namibia to independence from apartheid South Africa in 1990. SWAPO also won a majority in the National Assembly, securing 51 of the 96 elected seats. Her victory, however, is not without controversy. The November 27th vote was marred by technical difficulties and paper ballot shortages, leading to a delay in results as voting was extended in some places. Namibian voter Rodney Narip expresses his skepticism.
I think that the opposition parties, whoever lost, should just take the L. You know, they should just take the L's, work on their strategies, come back better. You know, because it doesn't help that, you know, the previous election, we are voting electronically, it was faster. They complained, we went back to the ballots. Now that we are doing ballots, it's taking long, they're complaining again. So it doesn't really help. So
the biggest opposition party is the Independent Patriots for Change Party, or IPC. Its members said they will challenge the results in court, calling the electoral process deeply flawed. Political analysts had said a SWAPO victory was uncertain due to growing frustration with high levels of unemployment and inequality, but that the party retained strong roots in rural areas and loyalty among older voters due to the national liberation struggle. For her part, Nandi-Ndaitwah is expressing confidence.
I'm saying to the Namibian people, as we have been telling you throughout the campaign, for us in the SWAPO party and the team that I'm going to lead, we have made commitments, and I'm saying to you, we are going to do what we have told you. Thank you for your trust and confidence on us. Thank you very much.
Elsewhere, record numbers of migrants from West Africa have arrived on Spain's Canary Islands this year, according to the latest government figures. Spain plans to offer visas to hundreds of thousands of undocumented migrants who are already in the country, as the government says it needs young workers to boost its economy. Henry Ridgewell has that story.
About 41,425 migrants arrived by boat on Spain's Canary Islands from West Africa between January 1st and November 30th, according to government figures, an all-time record. Most are from Mali, Senegal, and Morocco. Adult migrants are held at camps as they await transfer to the Spanish mainland. Among the residents is 36-year-old Bokar Gueye from Mauritania.
They will give the tickets to everyone, but it is not easy. Everyone will wait their turn. With all the difficulties at sea, I think that the rest, we can be patient.
Spain is bucking the political trend against migration in much of the rest of Europe. Madrid has announced plans to offer visas to 300,000 undocumented migrants every year for the next 3 years, allowing them to stay and find work. Spain needs young workers' taxes to fund the pensions and healthcare of its aging population, according to the Minister for Migration, Elma Saiz.
Spain must choose between being an open and prosperous country or being a closed and poor country, and we have chosen the former. That is why there are already 2.9 million foreigners paying monthly social security contributions.
The visas will only be offered to migrants already in Spain. Simultaneously, Madrid says it is clamping down on new arrivals by striking deals with African states to curb migrant departures and increase offshore patrols. Spain has also called for the EU border agency Frontex to resume operations in the region. But on the Canary Islands, tensions are growing. Spanish residents have staged demonstrations against the high levels of immigration. Protest leader Rudy Royman.
Right now, we don't need immigrants to work. What we need is to give work to the Canaries and to the Spanish in general. We must take care of our land, of our people, of our children, and encourage Canarians and Spaniards to have children. Because if not, what will be left of Spain and the Canary Islands? We will lose our identity.
The migration debate is overshadowed by tragedy. The journey from Africa's Atlantic coast to the Canary Islands remains one of the deadliest routes to Europe. Aid agencies estimate around 1,000 people die every month attempting the crossing. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
And on the opposite side of the continent, a group of Somali youths is working to protect the country's marine environment by organizing weekly beach cleanups in Mogadishu. Despite limited support, they have collected over 2 million kilograms of trash in recent months. Their dedication was recently recognized with a Global Arab Volunteer Award in Beirut, Lebanon, as Mohammed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Young people in Somalia remove plastic and other trash from beaches in the capital city, Mogadishu, as part of a cleanup initiative they started. The volunteers, many with environmental conservation degrees, also raise awareness about how pollution can harm natural resources, which locals rely on for food and jobs. Raqiya Hassan is a long-time volunteer.
We are in the 167th week of our beach cleanup campaign, and this week we focused on cleaning Lido Beach. Our goal is to protect the environment and preserve marine life.
The group was recognized with an Arab Volunteer Award in Beirut, Lebanon, in April. Abdisalam Mohammed, the group's deputy leader.
Our dedicated volunteers from the cleanup campaign have participated in international competitions because of the impact of our work, which has enabled us to win international medals.
The volunteers have made significant improvements to the beaches, gradually restoring their natural beauty. Community volunteer Usman Yusuf, who has lived in clean, well-developed cities like Berlin and Munich, encourages volunteers to uphold high cleanliness standards and see their work as a noble cause.
I encourage these volunteers to strive to replicate that cleanliness in their own country. Some young people are actively engaged in this important work.
The youth's beach cleanup initiative is commendable, but often lacks government support. Yasser Bafo, a senior tourism advisor, explains that this is not a dismissal of the youth's efforts, but rather a result of the government's focus on other pressing issues.
The efforts of these young people lack the government's role, such as offering encouragement or recognition for their contributions and hard work, which they truly deserve.
The volunteers also emphasize the vital connection between a clean environment and community health. Mohammed Sheikh Noor, VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.